quite gotten everything set yet, but this is beginning of chapter 13. Of course, this is not going to be on the test. Is that correct? Yes, that is correct. Let's do some classroom management issues. What is due? What's happening on Wednesday morning at 8 a.m.? Test. And you'll come in, and theoretically, at least the test will be ready and sitting upside down, around scattered around here, thither, and yon, so that you can have just sit down, and we'll have a prayer, and we'll begin. Then also on Thursday, there will be supposed to be a key terms quiz. Is that correct? And I've lowered the stress level by making that take home. Then there's also a reading guide, and that's supposed to be due Friday. Is that correct? Yes. I've delayed that, and I've just told. And then I've delayed that, I think, until, what did I say, Monday? Yeah, Monday. So the reading guide is scheduled for Friday, but it's actually going to be due Monday. I'll try to send that around and make those corrections in your calendar. And then also, I think it's Sunday night, or no, is it Tuesday? Tuesday then is the homework. It's not open? Well, how do I... pardon me. let's just open this thing up right now. There's Sapling, and let's see if I can figure this. This is interesting to do this kind of training as you watch. That's correct. Oh, one. Is that going to get it in there? Did I make a tap? Do this, and so we go down here, and so, yeah, I don't, that's that, so how do I, what am I supposed to do to get it to go here? Hold on. Hide, show. Oh. All righty then, I guess that will take care of it. Does it now show up? I wonder what the gray meant. Yay! There it is. I learn something new every day. I don't know why it didn't strike me that I need to do it. But what? Yeah, and notice it's way off. It works now. Yes. Hide, show. So you both have to give it a date. Oh. Which means, okay, here's the, I did learn something. It means that you could set the dates for all these things for the entire semester and then just go in and hit hide or not hide, and it'll show up. Okay, never mind. Okay, are all of them now available that I have set up? I think so. Okay, good. So I can log out. So it now shows up, is that right? There's some of them only have five or six questions to them, and all of them are directly related to the test material, except for chapter 13 here. All right, did we end up here? I think we did, didn't we? I think we did this in terms of writing down the blanks, is that right? Yes, and so we now have the flaming... transitions. I thought that was so cool when I first put that in. It's starting to look kind of hokey now. and I don't know how much more there is on this overhead. What's left? Anything left? One more? That's it? Excellent. Again, I did not modify it to give myself a stop sign. All right, so we're now talking about... Now talking about adrenal cortex. Yay! Adrenal cortex, one of my favorite organs. I have no idea It's simply because it produces lots of epinephrine, and I like epinephrine, but it does a lot of other things. It's a very important hormone for regulation of metabolism in the system-wide approach, because it produces these various hormones that regulate all these very important functions. And 50 exist, my goodness. There's probably more that have yet to be discovered. That's the interesting thing about blood. You'd think after 150 years of looking at the human body, especially in the last 50, where we've had such marvelous instrumentation, that we would have pretty much characterized everything in the blood. There's still stuff in the blood we have no idea what it's for. No idea. We have no idea if it goes up at a certain time or down at a certain time, or if it's responsible for cancer or not responsible for cancer. All kinds of things in the blood we have no idea about. Okay. And so you've got the glucocorticoids, mineral corticoids, androgens, and estrogens. Again, we could spend an entire class, an entire semester class, looking at these hormones. We simply don't have the time. I'm just giving you an overview of them. The gonadal steroidal hormones, of course, sexual differentiation, secondary sexual characteristics. Androgens accelerate muscle growth, called anabolic steroids. Of course, we're familiar with that. If you take them in excess, it does nasty things to your body. You look good on the surface, okay, but yeah, not much happening anywhere else. It's not very good. Okay, embryonic males with their gonads removed become phenotypic females. So it is the presence of these hormones that make men men. In other words, that even if you have the female chromosomes, if you don't have the right hormones circulating, you're still going to look like a girl. So, a female, which is fine if that's what's happened to you. Of course, you have the pituitary gland. Oh, man, the pituitary gland is another. One of these things is about the size of a peanut, but produces just a tremendous mixture of powerful, powerful hormones, among many, is this growth hormone. You have a gigantism with an excess and a deficiency, you get dwarfism. The receptor exists at a monomeric unit that dimerizes upon binding the hormone. Now, this line right here, receptor exists as monomeric units that dimerize upon binding the hormone. This is the next overhead. We're talking about a whole classification of receptors called receptor tyrosine kinases. Oddly enough, in this text, because it's a biochemistry text as opposed to a systems physiology text, when we are going to look at primarily what's happening at the cellular level and lower, the hormones, yes, we admit are circulating, but that's sort of a systems approach. Here we're going to be looking at the enzyme receptors themselves, or the ligand receptors, the hormone receptors themselves. So the first thing you're going to see is receptors outside the cell. Next blank is called kinase. Next blank is monomer. Next blank is dimerization. Next blank is autophosphorylation. AUTOPHOSPHORYLATION, autophosphorylation. And then the abbreviation for receptor tyrosine kinases is called RTK. RTK. And the RTKs come in a truly mind-boggling list of receptors, many of which are built like Legos, in which you have different cassettes that are combined in different combinations, and you end up having a particular receptor. Receptor abbreviations, you need to be able to tell me these. HGFR, human growth factor R. EGFR, epithelial growth factor R receptor. IGF, insulin-like growth factor. PDGF, platelet-derived growth factor. FGF, fibroblast growth factor. the VEGF, vesicular endothelial growth factor receptor in this case. Then you have blank is TRK, tropomyosin receptor kinase. Then you have EPHR, ephrin receptor. And then you have RET, rearranged during transfection factor receptor. And I, all right, now I got to go back through this whole thing again. Okay, as I fill this in, let's talk about it. Looking at the diagram on the upper right of the figure, you see a model for a receptor tyrosine kinase, where it appears that there are two identical monomers that bind at some point. And notice you have some sort of ligand on receptor on the outside. That's this A part. And then you, in this case, you have some beta function that penetrates through the penetrates through this thing. The interesting thing about this diagram isn't not completely functionally correct. As you see here, this particular model has some sort of covalent connection between the two identical subunits. That's not typically what happens with an RTK. What typically happens with an RTK is that you have these different monomers that you see here that when they bind to the ligand, physically associate with each other. And so you end up having these interior cytoplasmic components physically approach each other. Those components turn out to have an enzymatic activity inherently in them, and that activity is called a tyrosine kinase. So guess what a kinase does? Phosphorylates. And guess what a tyrosine kinase does? Now, why do you think it phosphorylates a tyrosine as opposed to phenylalanine? What does a tyrosine have in its structure that a phenylalanine does not? An OH. What amino acid side chains do kinases like to attack? The serine side chains, the threonine side chains, and the tyrosine side chains, because each of those side chains have what kind of functional group on them? OHs. Okay. And I think I'm supposed to stop there, isn't it?
One more.
Do I dare? All right, now then, I just got to make sure I don't press the wrong button. Okay, so what do you think happens when the tyrosine kinases approach each other? As it turns out, they phosphorylate each other. They phosphorylate each other. So, for example, what happens is, and this is an odd thing to do, I know. I'm just looking for somebody to help me. You don't mind. What I need for you to do is stick your arm out like this. Just stick your arm like that. There you go. Now, if I am, in fact, let's say, a human growth factor, you're a monomer that's a human growth factor, I'm a monomer that's a human growth factor, we are inside the cell, there's the cell membrane, the ceiling, and parts of us penetrate through that and have an exterior part, okay? But we're physically far apart, okay? On the outside of the cell, the ligand lands, and it immediately begins to, which one did I say we were? Oh, yeah. So immediately it aggregates two of them physically together so they become a dimer, and we are literally pulled toward each other. At that point, this kinase activity phosphorylates a tyrosine on you, and your kinase activity phosphorylates a tyrosine on me. That's called auto what? Autophosphorylation. At the point that the phosphorylation occurs, the activity of the interior becomes turned on, as it were. The receptor begins to have some sort of activity within the cell upon the phosphorylation of those tyrosines. Not before. And they get phosphorylated only when the monomers physically associate as a dimer because of the presence of the hormone. Different model. I want you to hold this. You're going to be the hormone. Okay? And I want you to hold it like this. Okay? The hormone has two attachment points, let's just say, for speculation. I am a PD. Oh, no, I like VEGF. I'm a VEGF. And so I exist as a monomer here and a monomer here, and I'm physically dissociated. The blue is in the interior of the cell, and my hands are in the exterior of the cell. All right? And so the level of the hormone begins to rise due to some sort of development issue, perhaps, and it begins to accumulate. I associate, and this happens. As these physically come close together, my elbows touch in the interior of the cell and autophosphorylate each other. So, unphosphorylated, phosphorylated. Unphosphorylated, phosphorylated. That's how a receptor tyrosine kinase operates. Now, this is just a little different. This one here has, it's still a receptor tyrosine kinase, but here it is actually connected together. This is an unusual one. The dimers, the monomers are actually covalently bound through cysteines here, and it exists as a dimer, but that's a fairly unusual thing. But it does not autophosphorylate until a ligand lands on the receptor. Okay, notice here where you have a variety of receptors that you, of course, do not need to memorize this. You don't need to memorize any of this. This is for illustration showing you that depending on the kind of structure you have, you can use different pieces. For example, here's this RET. It uses this repeating cassette and this repeating cassette, the AB, and together makes an external part of the receptor. You have a different combination here for this. You have a different combination here. The EGFR is a different combination as well, but nevertheless, they're used over and over in different enzymes. Okay, let's take a look. What happens in the interior of the cell? What happens in the interior of the cell? Now, this is a classic action. First blank is called RAS. First blank is called RAS. Next blank is called phosphated. Next blank is called capital S, capital H, 2, SH2. The next blank is SH3. The next blank is SOS. Capital S, lowercase O, lowercase S. Next blank is GEF, guanine exchange factor. So the GEF stands for guanine exchange factor. Next is GDP. The next blank is RAS again, RAS. The next blank is GTP again. The next blank is GTPase. And the last blank is G8, not last blank that I've listed here, but the next blank is GAPS, G-A-P-S. This has nothing to do with the gap of the metabolism of glucose at all. How many more lines do I have? A couple more, okay. Begins the RAS signaling cascade. And last one, RAF. I'm not sure what RAF, the name is uncertain. There's one more. Okay, MEK, M-E-K, MAP, kinase. Next is MAP-K, mitogen-activated protein kinase, or also called ERKs. FOS, JUN, and MEK, these are eukaryotic transcription factors. Is that the last one?
Two more,
okay. Variants of these genes are oncogenes. Oncogenes. Is that the last one?
One more.
Thank you, Daniel. Necessary companion enzymes are protein, tyrosine. Phosphatases exist in cascades and are highly regulated as well. So, let's run through this here. So, now, we're going to run through this. This is going to give you a good model. Imagine this happening in real time.
if you would, ladies and gentlemen. So you have an RTK, which stands for what? Receptor tyrosine kinase. You have some sort of growth factor. In this case, it's a protein that does that. It's a protein. The protein growth factor increases in concentration, and it causes the two monomers to then bind together to that protein growth factor and become a dimer temporarily. Immediately upon dimerization, what happens to the tyrosines? Phosphorylate. What is the Y right there?
Gamma?
Nope. Actually, it's a good guess, though. I didn't ask you to memorize that. It's the single letter designation for tyrosine. Y is the single letter designation for tyrosine. So what does that mean where you have a phosphate pointed to that Y? You have a phosphated tyrosine. So these autophosphorylated to each other, and when that occurs, you now have something called an SH2 domain that can bind to that region where the tyrosine is that's phosphated. So the SH2 is a repeated domain. You see this in a variety of proteins and a variety of cell types and a variety of species. There are some genetic differences between them, but essentially they all have the same function, and that is they bind to phosphorylated tyrosines of RTKs. But that particular protein structure is used over and over and over again in a wide variety of settings. Additionally, attached to that typically is this GERB2-SEM5 domain or protein that has something known as an SH3 domain. In other words, it's a segment of a protein that has similar structure and function over a variety of other types of proteins. To that SH3 domain binds the protein called SOS. This SOS. The SOS then binds temporarily to the RAS protein, which is in this case inactive. The presence of the SOS causes the GDP to be ejected and replaced by a GTP. All right, let's review. You have a hormone on the exterior of the cell. It binds to a monomer, two monomers of an RTK. They then dimerize. In the interior of the cell, there are selected tyrosines that then do what? Are phosphorylated by each of the other monomeric units. Upon their phosphorylation, they then become a binding site for what repeated or what cassette type receptor? What is it? SH2. In this case, SH2 is bound to an enzyme, to a protein called GERB2-SEM5. Where do they get these names from? One of the most confusing things in biochemistry is that you can have a protein that has a particular function in a particular species of cell or type of cell, and you can have that same protein that does that same function in a different species, and it's going to get a different name because a particular species may have been worked on by a particular lab and they gave it a name, and this other species was worked on by a different lab and they gave it their own name, and when by the time they discovered the two functionalities were the same, both names were in the literature. And so this particular protein was discovered in a variety of different cell types, species, and then given two names to try to help meld the idea that it's a protein with a similar structure, same function in a wide variety of cell types. All right. So, but each of these GERB2-SEM5s have a domain that's known as an SH3, which binds to another protein called SOS. I want you to know what SOS does. What is it classified as? It's classified as a GEF. And what does GEF stand for? So here you have GDP. GDP exists on this RAS. When GDP exists on the RAS is inactive. Okay? When the GDP exists on the RAS is what? What's it say up there? Inactive. If I would exchange that GDP for a GTP, that RAS moves from inactive to what? Active. What protein helps with that exchange to move it from inactive to active? SOS, because SOS is classified as a what? Guanine exchange factor. That is correct. All right, so now, because the growth factors on the exterior, dimerizing the hormone, autophosphorylating that tyrosine, binding to that SH2 domain, which brings along the GERB2 SM5 that has SH3 domain, which binds the SOS, which initiates an exchange with RAS, which causes the RAS to hold GTP for a while, the RAS now becomes active. Following the active RAS, another entire cascade of changes occur, primarily through phosphorylation. The RAS phosphorylates RAP, which phosphorylates MEK, which phosphorylates MAP. That MAP phosphorylates other kinases and also moves into the interior of the nucleus, which then acts and phosphorylates MYC-FOS-JUNE. And when these are phosphorylated, DNA transcription occurs. Let's run through this. The SOS protein is now activated. That stimulates the release of GTP from the inactive RAS protein, which exchanges it with a GTP, making it RAS active. Underline this, please. The RAS protein has a slow GTPase activity. The RAS protein has a slow GTPase activity. Just underline that part. The RAS has a timer, which means that it's turned on in the presence or when a GTP is bound to it. But the site that holds the GTP has an inherent enzyme activity that's called the GTPase, which breaks down the GTP to GDP. At the point that breaks it down to GDP, the RAS then becomes what? Inactive. It's sort of like having a switch on lights in a room. And you turn it on when you come in and you leave. And after a few minutes, it automatically does what? Turns itself off. Well, this is what's happening with RAS. It's maybe stimulated once to bind the GTP. But the GTP doesn't stay there forever. It slowly gets hydrolyzed to GDP, and it shifts then back to the inactive, and it has to be re-stimulated to make that RAS active again. That's excellent. I'm glad that a very powerful cascade like this turns itself off. Sometimes it does not turn itself off fast enough, however. So there's another enzyme called, now after the GTPase activity, there's a dash, made more active by the presence of GAPS, GTPase activating protein. The active RAS GTP complex begins a RAS signaling cascade. So this degradation of GTP is too slow, so there are presence of GAPS that increase activity to turn off faster, which means it makes the overall system more responsive to exterior changes. All right? So then, here we go. The RAF, I'm not sure of the name. The MEK is called MAP kinase kinase. Then that phosphorylates a mitogen-activated protein kinase, also known as an ERK, and that phosphorylates the FOS, JUNE, and MYC eukaryotic transcription factors. Variants of VOS, JUN, and MYC are known as oncogenes. In other words, that if these things have some error in them, in their genetic code to make bad transcription factors, you can get cancer out of them. And that bad gene is called oncogene. What's onc mean in Latin? Cancer. Oncogene. All right. Now then, since these get turned on by phosphorylation, is phosphorylation a covalent effect? Say yes. Did it require an enzyme to do it? Yes. So if you connected the phosphate to the tyrosine, using an enzyme, what must you have to disconnect it? Also an enzyme. So there are just as many enzymes that there are here to occur to make all this phosphorylation. Guess what? There's as many phosphatases to dephosphorylate all this. So there's just as complicated a system turning all this stuff off as there is turning it on. Woohoo! All right. Now, oh, look at this. I think we've seen this one before. I did not have a quiz that dealt with the RTKs, did I? No, I didn't. But I do have a quiz that related to this. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so we're catching up with our memorization. All right. Okay, boom. Again, I did not find out. Where do I stop this on? And desensitization, is that it? One more. On, note the action of sildenafil. That's funny. Okay, so you've memorized this before. Let's see if it makes any sense. We're again talking about membrane receptors and signaling cascades. We just had a quick talk about a quick overview of the RTK system. This is now the heteromeric G proteins. First thing on this blank, first blank is heterotrimeric. Heterotrimeric. Next blank is GTPases. Next blank is called signal. Next blank is vesicle. Vesicle. The next blank is translation. Okay. Next blank is glucagon. Next blank is 7TM. Capital T, capital M. 7-TM. The next blank is GPCRS. GPCRS. Last blank is desynthesization. Desynthesization. If I could pronounce it correctly, it'd be helpful. All right. So you have that all written down? Let's talk about it. These are the G protein. This is a G protein regulatory cascade. This has a tremendous role to play in virtually every cell in your body. There are several families of these G proteins. I'm only going to give you an overview of one. Many of the drugs that you are going to use and many of the drugs that you will be using as they get developed in the future are going to be targeting this particular mechanism because it controls so much in the body. And we know a lot about it. Notice I say here it's heterotrimeric. What do I mean by heterotrimeric? What do I mean by trimeric? Three parts. What do I mean by hetero? Three different parts. Alpha, beta, gamma. In this case, there's an S alpha, which means it's stimulatory. Over here, there's an I alpha, which means it's inhibitory. So you can have a G protein. You can have the G proteins that are inhibitory as here or stimulatory, depending on the circumstances. It's a superfamily, which means there are a wide variety of GTPases, all based on their where the species of origin and their function. Responsible for signal transduction, moving an external signal to the inside of the cell. Vesicle trafficking, many of the regulatory proteins designed for vesicle fusion or blebbing come from the G proteins. actin microfilament growth, as these microfilaments grow, that's regulated by G proteins. Translation is regulated, and also protein carp targeting. In other words, where do these proteins go once they're formed? The G protein coupled receptors include glucagon. Glucagon. Insulin is not a G protein receptor, but glucagon is. The glucagon receptor and many others are noted to have a 7TM morphology. What that means is this, and write this down. There are 7 transmembrane segments in the protein. 7 transmembrane segments. Typically 7 alpha helices that penetrate through the membrane. And they're all clustered together. 7 of them. And when they began to examine all the G proteins, they discovered these receptors and noted that particular and peculiar morphology. Over 60% of the therapeutic drugs target G protein receptors. So you as biochemists, when you give something, you're going to kind of laugh and go, wow, here's another G protein receptor I'm giving as a drug. Dr. Novak would be kind of laughing today right now. All right, at any rate. So the receptors themselves are called G protein coupled receptors, and they're subject to desensitization. In other words, that you can keep hitting these things, but there are mechanisms that will eventually slow down the response. Eventually slow down the response so that the cell is not constantly being overstimulated. Let's take a look at what's happening here, and we're going to take a look at the first half. First half here, very common structure. We have some sort of receptor. The ligand binds the receptor. There's a conformational change, and that conformational change is transmitted to the inactive G-meric trimer, the heterotrimeric trimer. So sitting there, unstimulated, this thing has the 3 units all aggregated together, bound to the unstimulated receptor. When the ligand binds to it, the conformation changes and these 3 units are released. At that point, what happens to the GDP that's bound in the inactive state? It's replaced by a what? GTP. So the stimulatory alpha subunit now has that GTP there. When the GTP is there, that alpha subunit is stimulatory. And notice that green light. What does that mean it's doing to the adenylate cyclase? Turning it on. And what does it turned on adenylate cyclase do? It takes 4 ATP, eliminates 4 pyrophosphates, and make 4 CAMP. What's the CAMP stand for? Cyclic AMP. It's broadly classified as a second messenger. That's correct. Are there other second messengers in the cell? Yes. Are we going to run into them? Yes. But cyclic AMP is a second messenger. What was the first messenger? The signal itself. The second messenger is the one that turns up in the interior of the cell. So you start making high levels of cyclic AMP. Yay. And we'll find out what happens with that. But is that a permanent situation in which you, because this is always turned on, the adenylate cyclase is always turned on, and you're always making cyclic high levels of cyclic AMP? How do you turn off the stimulatory alpha subunit? What is it? Different receptor. Yes, this thing perhaps falls off. But that GTP is still there. Which means, what? You need an inhibitory pathway, exactly. And there are this. These actually can act independently, depending on the thing. Those are all good questions. Those are all good comments. But I have to point out to you, I have to point out to you that, remember, how did you turn off the RAS? How did you turn off RAS? The RAS itself had its own what? GTPase. The RAS itself contained its own, just like the alpha subunit here does. There is a GTPase, a activity there that will, over time, break down GDP and make GTP and make GDP at the point that its self-contained GTPase makes GDP. This goes back here. This goes back. Unfortunately, this is actually incorrect. I mean, it's hard, difficult to show, but notice if you would, notice the details here. Here you've got water coming in and hydrolyzing one of the phosphates for this, and notice what do you get? Notice that circle right there. What I'm circling, you get the G alpha subunit with now a GDP attached to it. See that dot? That's like a water of hydration thing. So it's like that. It's not what that is. So that means that this GDP is hydrolyzed to the GDP. At that point, this stimulatory subunit becomes inactive. It recombines reversibly with the alpha and the beta, the gamma and the gamma and the beta subunits, and reforms the inactive trimer. So the alpha subunit turns itself off by creating a GDP. At the point it turns itself off by making a GDP, it reassociates itself with the gamma and the beta and makes the inactive trimer. And that reassociates itself with the receptor waiting to be stimulated again. Right? So, what turns off this alpha subunit? The subunit itself. And so the GTP becomes GDP automatically and restores the inactive step. Notice what this does here. Cholera toxin. Cholera toxin. What do you think that cholera toxin with that stop sign means? Stops the GTPase activity. What does that do then to the alpha subunit? Is it always on or always off? It's always what? It's always on. That's exactly correct. It's always on. And so what's happened, since it's always on, what's it doing in this case, the adenylate cyclase? It's producing massive excesses of cyclic AMP, which, at least in the epithelial cells of the intestinal tract, turns on a large flow of ions into the gut. That high concentration of ions in the gut then means that osmosis moves liquid from the intestinal tract into the interior of the lumen. And you get what? Diarrhea. And it's so stimulatory and refuses to be turned off that it'll pump enough ions into the gut and you can lose enough water that you would eventually dehydrate and die. That's the cholera toxin. And it's acting on that GTPase of the alpha subunit. Now, is there some other going? Yes. You go over here, and you've got this inhibitory external signal. You got this inhibitor. Let me finish this. Inhibitory receptor. Here you've got the same process in which that inhibitory alpha subunit is activated by the presence of GDP. In this case, the pertussis toxin prevents the inhibitory signal from landing on here, and therefore, even though you have the inhibitory signal, this remains inactive. So pertussis toxin causes a lack of an inhibitory signal to land on the adenylate cyclase. We'll continue this discussion on Wednesday. Is that correct? No. I could cancel the test. That's true. I probably shouldn't, though. It would probably irritate more people than help.
Arise, my soul, arise. Shake off your guilty fears. The bleeding sacrifice in my behalf appears. Before the throne he stands. Before the throne he stands, my name is written on his hand. me to intercede is all redeeming love, his precious blood to plead. Before the throne of grace, before the throne of grace, he gladly takes my sinful place. My bleeding wounds he bears, received on me for